Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. In this episode, I'm in conversation with an accelerator engineer who's written a fascinating book that describes how the cryogenic superpowers of superfluid helium have made possible some of the most important scientific discoveries in physics. But first, a word from our sponsor. We'd like to thank Pfeiffer Vacuum for sponsoring this podcast. The company is one of the world's leading developers, manufacturers, and suppliers of vacuum solutions. Pfeiffer Vacuum has been producing innovative end-to-end vacuum solutions since 1890, and over the years has collaborated with some of the largest and most ambitious scientific experiments. The support of young scientists in cutting-edge research is of great importance to Pfeiffer Vacuum. Many accelerator facilities operate large vacuum systems using superfluid helium to cool components, such as the ESS in Sweden, the European EXFEL in Germany, and the LHC at CERN. Vacuum products from Pfeiffer Vacuum meet the highest quality and engineering standards and provide vacuum solutions precisely tailored to the needs of scientists and customers. Find out more at pfeiffer-vacuum.com. The effects of quantum mechanics are all around us. But the quantum properties of matter are generally only apparent at the microscopic level. Superfluidity is an exception, and some of its bizarre characteristics can be seen with the naked eye. What's more, superfluids have found several important applications in science and technology, and are used in multi-ton quantities today. To talk about superfluids, I'm joined down the line by John Wisand, who is Senior Accelerator Engineer at the European Spallation Source and Adjunct Professor at Lund University in Sweden. He's a specialist in cryogenic engineering, and I've just read his new book, Superfluid, How a Quantum Fluid Revolutionized Modern Science. Hi, John. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Hamish. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And congratulations on your book, John. I really enjoyed it. And I've also reviewed it for Physics World. And at the end of the podcast, I'll tell people where they can read that review. But I thought it was a fascinating book. Thanks for writing
it. Very happy to hear that.
So as you do in the book, John, can you start off with a simple description of what a superfluid is?
So the material that I talk about in the book is superfluid helium. And superfluid helium, or as it's sometimes called, helium-2, is the second liquid phase of helium. So if you take helium gas and you cool it to 4.2 Kelvin in atmospheric pressure, it becomes a liquid. If you further cool it down to 2.2 Kelvin and below, it has a second liquid phase. This is known as helium-2. And while helium-1, the first liquid phase, behaves like a standard fluid and it doesn't really have any unusual properties, the second liquid phase, helium-2, or superfluid helium, does have very interesting properties, among which are the ability to flow through small holes without any pressure drop and exhibiting what we call zero viscosity. So that is what's known as superfluidity, and thus we call this second liquid phase of helium-2 superfluid helium. It has other properties. It has a very efficient heat transfer mechanism that's not seen anywhere else in the universe. It has things called quantized vortices in it that explain rotation and potentially are a useful model for turbulence. It would only be interesting scientifically, but as it turns out, the properties of superfluid helium have very important and useful technical applications, principally in the cooling of superconducting magnets, superconducting RF cavities, and infrared astronomy. And so because of these practical applications, it's widely used in the scientific world and is responsible for some of the largest scientific instruments currently in existence.
And John, in your book, you talk about something called the two-fluid model of helium-2. And that was something I suppose that as a condensed matter physicist really intrigued me. It's it provides a very useful way of understanding some of these very useful properties of the superfluid. Can you describe this model?
Sure. The physics, the quantum physics behind the existence of helium-2 or superfluid helium is that a certain fraction of the atoms in the helium have undergone something known as Bose-Einstein condensation. They've condensed down to the ground state of the ground quantum state. And this means that the those atoms or that fraction of the helium are the ones that have zero viscosity and zero entropy. And what the two-fluid model does is it says, let's imagine that helium-2 is divided into two completely mixed together fluids. One that we'll call the normal fluid component, which has finite viscosity and finite entropy, and one called the superfluid component, which has zero viscosity and zero entropy. And each of these fluids will have their own velocities, and each of them will have their own densities. And with this as a background, you can then write the conservation of mass, momentum, and energy equations for each of the two fluids. And you can add terms into these equations that discuss the interaction of the two fluids together. And from that, you can do a very good job of explaining transport properties such as heat transfer. You can explain the existence of things like second sound and the fountain effect without having to go through the rigorous, you know, quantum mechanical model. There is a more rigorous model, which is really really thought of as the true microscopic model of helium-2, and that was developed by Lev Landau. But that model requires a much deeper understanding of quantum mechanics and, quite frankly, harder math. The two-fluid model allows people to really understand the transport properties as well as use those properties to design practical behaviors. So whenever we do this in large-scale cryogenics or in accelerator design, things like that, we use this two-fluid model. We don't use the more fundamental model.
And one thing that struck me about the superfluid state of helium is that it, although it does have these, you know, sort of wondrous properties like the ability to flow uphill, it also in a sort of practical way behaves as a fluid in the sense that you can have it flow along a pipe to where you want it to go in an application. So it struck to me that it was almost like a perfect material in a sense to work with.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, sometimes the universe is kind. One of the things that was developed as people started to move from simply looking at helium-2 into practical applications was exactly this question. If you have this material that has zero viscosity under certain conditions, can you do useful things with it? And research done in a number of laboratories and universities worldwide, mainly in the 70s and 80s, showed that while superfluid helium, if you look at it in bulk and you're not pushing it through very small holes in porous media, for instance, or in very thin films, but if you look at it in bulk, the fluid mechanical properties are basically the same as a conventional fluid. And this goes back to the explanation for this is that the quantized vortices that exist in the superfluid component interact with the viscosity of the normal fluid component in such a way that the whole fluid, the bulk fluid, looks like a conventional fluid. And this is tremendously helpful because it means not only can we do practical things with it, but we also can use practical scaling laws. So the law that we use in engineering to discuss the pressure drop of a fluid through a pipe applies completely to helium-2. You just have to use the right density and the right temperatures. Same is true with sizing of pumps, sizing of valves, all these sort of practical things that have standard engineering rules still apply to helium too. Where this breaks down is if we're doing anything about transferring heat, or if we're doing things in small porous media or thin films.
And it is the transfer of heat, isn't it, at very low temperatures where helium-2 really comes into its own. It's an incredibly good conductor of heat, isn't it? And I think the two-fluid model has a very beautiful explanation of why that is.
Yes, that's true. The helium-2 has a very unique mechanism for heat transfer. It's actually the only material that we know that does this, though I think the superfluid phase of helium-3 also does this. But in helium-4, the way this works is it has something known as internal convection. And this is not standard convection, and it's not conduction. In fact, what happens is there's an interplay between the superfluid component and the normal fluid component. And so if you imagine a tube with a heated wall on one end and a cooled bath on the other, and it's filled with helium-2, what will happen is that the normal fluid component will flow away from the heated wall carrying heat, and it will be replaced by superfluid component flowing in the opposite direction towards the heated wall, which then eventually heats up and becomes normal fluid. And so you have this circulation. And this is extremely efficient. It is, under certain conditions, 1,000 times better than pure copper under those conditions at the same temperatures. So it's a very, very efficient way. And it has another function. As a result of being very efficient, it means that you don't really get boiling in the body of helium-2. If you have a bath of helium-2 and you apply heat to it, as long as you keep it in the helium-2 state, the heat will be transferred to the surface by internal convection, and then it will evaporate quietly off the surface, but it won't boil and have bubbles in the surface. And that has very important technical advantages, particularly in the area of cooling superconducting cavities.
Actually, there is one thing that I wanted to ask you about this internal convection process. Is the material actually moving, or is it sort of converting from one component to another in that situation?
So, yeah, it is not moving in bulk. So if you were to have internal, if you did the experiment that I just mentioned and you put a flow meter there, you would not see any movement of the helium. What the two-fluid model does, and remember it's only a phenomenological model, is it assumes that the normal fluid has a velocity and the superfluid has a velocity and they're moving in opposite directions.
Okay.
But that's just the model. The actual physical reality is that the fluid is not moving. You wouldn't see a flow in a flow meter under those conditions.
Okay. And that's the thing that makes it very efficient. Right. Yeah. Okay. And another sort of phenomenon that I think has proved useful is this idea of a fountain, a superfluid fountain, where you can pump a superfluid without any mechanical parts. And that also can be explained elegantly using the two-fluid model, can't it?
Yes. In that model, what you have, a superfluid pump typically will have a porous media with sort of micron-sized holes in it and helium on both sides of it, and then a heater at one side of it. And so when you turn the heater on, what will happen is that the superfluid component will move, because it can move through the porous media towards the heater and thus become normal when it gets heated up. But the normal fluid component can't go back through the porous media because it has finite viscosity. And so what you wind up doing is building up a pressure where the heater is. And so this allows you to pump helium at fairly high rates. You just have to build the pump big enough without any mechanical components. And this is particularly useful in space applications where people are always very worried about mechanical reliability. And this eliminates yet another moving part at low temperatures.
And I think in the book you did mention that this was done successfully in space.
Yes, there was a project called SHOOT, which was superfluid helium on orbit transfer. And it was an experiment flown on the space shuttle in the late 80s, early 90s. And what they did was they had two doors of superfluid helium, and connecting between them was a transfer line. And in that transfer line, or actually in one of the doors, there was this superfluid fountain pump. So they moved helium from one doer to the other and back again while they were in zero G. And the motivation for this was that in those days, they thought that they would be in a mode where they would bring superfluid helium up to, say, a satellite that used it or to an experiment on the space station, and they'd want to refill the helium. What's developed as time has gone on is that it turns out that's not actually the most practical thing to do. It's actually better to simply build the doer big enough and reduce the heat load and have it do it that way and not try to refill it, because the mission to refill it is as expensive typically as buying a new instrument. So that tends to be the better approach. But this experiment was very impressive, and it validated a lot of useful practical things about using helium-2 in space and helium-2 in general. So it was a useful experiment in that sense. The spinoffs are quite useful.
And in the book, you do spend some time talking about applications in space. So what was the first mission that successfully used helium-2?
The first real mission that used helium-2 in space was an infrared space telescope called IRIS that was launched in the 80s. It was a joint US-UK Netherlands project. And it was really the first satellite that did a sky-wide survey of the universe in the infrared bands. And in order to look in the infrared, you have to do two things. You have to get above the Earth's atmosphere, or most of the Earth's atmosphere, because the Earth's atmosphere will absorb IR radiation. And you have to be cold enough so that the sensors can detect the cold objects in space you're trying to look at. And it turns out that helium-2, if you operate these sensors at about 1.8K to 2K, they can then see most of the universe's dark material. And so when IRIS flew, it was a watershed sort of set of observations. No one had really seen the universe in these wavelengths before. And so they were able to see through dust clouds. They were able to see darker astronomical objects. And so it led to a series of telescopes flown in space, cooled with helium-2. And the James Webb telescope, which was just launched, also operates principally in the infrared band, though it does not use helium-2 to do that. It doesn't get quite as cold as some of the earlier telescopes, and it has some mechanical cryocoolers that can get down to the temperatures it needs.
And in the intro, I mentioned the fact that superfluid is used in multi-ton quantities, and I'm guessing that the bulk of that is in particle accelerators. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. It's used in two places in particle accelerators. It's used to cool superconducting magnets, and the reason you would cool a superconducting magnet to 2 Kelvin or so, 1.8 Kelvin, is that the principal superconducting material that we use these days is niobium titanium, and it performs better. It has higher current density and higher field strength at these lower temperatures. So that's one reason to do it. So it's used, all the magnets at the CERN experiment, or almost all the magnets at the CERN experiment, and at CERN at LHC, are cooled by superfluid helium. And then the other thing that's done, that's become more common in the last 10 or 15 years, and actually is used in more and more places, is the use of cooling superfluid helium, using superfluid helium to cool superconducting RF cavities. So these are, again, superconductors. They're made out of pure niobium, and they're used to accelerate particles, charged particles in accelerators, and they also perform better at 2 Kelvin. They are less lossy because it's a radio frequency superconductivity. There's still some losses, but they're significantly less, so you need less power to run them. at 2 Kelvin. And then the other big thing that helium-2 does in that application is I mentioned that there's no boiling in bulk helium-2. And boiling around the cavities can cause the cavities to lose their tuning because they're resonant devices. And so the fact that you are surrounding them with a coolant that can't boil is another big advantage to using it. So while CERN is the single largest user of helium-2, the bulk of helium-2 used in laboratories now, I think, is close to becoming this application in superconducting RF cavities, because these accelerators are used for many things, including free electron lasers and proton accelerators that derive neutron sources like my home institute and other things. So that's the other big application.
So at the European spallation source, which ultimately creates neutrons, you use helium-2 as a coolant, or are you planning on using it?
Right, the way we create neutrons at the European spallation source is we have a proton LINAC that we use to accelerate protons to very high energies. Those protons then strike a metal tungsten target, and there's an interaction at the nuclear level that essentially, if you will, boils off neutrons, and those neutrons are then sent out to scientific instruments. But the accelerator is about 400 meters in length, and 90% of the acceleration is done by superconducting RF cavities operating at 2 Kelvin. So we have a very large, about 3 kilowatt cooling helium refrigerator that operates at 2 Kelvin.
Right. And you mentioned that a lot of the early work for magnets, for helium-2 cooled magnets, was actually not done in the realms of particle physics. It was for magnetically confined fusion experiments. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The first real sort of application of helium-2 in an industrial sense occurred at the Tor Supra tokamak, which was built in Cadarache, France, back in the 80s. And their motivation there was twofold. It was designed to be the first tokamak or fusion experiment that used superconducting magnets. I mean, they all do now, but back then this was the first one because they wanted to go to longer plasma pulses and they couldn't really do that with conventional magnets. And at the same time, the designers of this decided that the advantage would be to use superfluid helium. So again, the magnets would be stronger at these lower temperatures. And it really became a very useful validation that you can use superfluid helium in large quantities. And they had to work out, the people in France that designed it from Grenoble and Cadarache really had to help work out the practical aspects of how you both handle helium-2, and people that provided the refrigerator for this, which was Air Liquide, had to develop a piece of technology known as a cold compressor that would allow them to efficiently and reliably get down to these helium-2 temperatures. And so those two developments have now been seen in all the later work.
Earlier on, you mentioned that, for example, in some space applications, mechanical cryo coolers are now being deployed instead of superfluid based ones. And I suppose in general, there is a worry about a shortage of helium because it is a finite resource. Do you think are we at sort of peak helium-2 cooling at the moment? And in the future, people will be developing maybe new ways of getting down to those temperatures? Or is superfluid helium-2 here to stay for a lot of applications?
I think it's probably fair to say that we're getting close to peak usage, if you will. There's a number of large accelerator projects on the books now that are being built principally in China and in the United States that do use helium-2. So it's not going anywhere anytime soon. But you are right in that one of the other technical trends of the last 30 years is the development of reliable mechanical coolers that can get down. They typically can't get down to helium-2 temperatures, but they can get down to below 4.2K. And that is useful in that you don't have to have large amounts of helium, and you don't have, and you can just recirculate what you have. This is really driven by the reliability of these. Was really driven by the space and the military that wanted to use these things for infrared detection. But now that that's done, it's relatively straightforward to go into a laboratory and see someone operating at, say, 20 Kelvin, a chemist or a biologist, and they don't have any liquid helium. They simply have a mechanical refrigerator that they turn on and gets them to those temperatures. And so, yes, I think that, you know, as time goes on, we should see more and more of that. The limit at the moment is the capacity of these devices at the very lowest temperatures. They tend to only be a few watts at 4.2K. So for big applications that need lots of heat removal, we're probably still going to look at liquid cryogens, at least for a while. But the trend certainly, I think, is that way.
And what about, you know, developments in new superconducting materials, new magnet designs? Is that could that something that affects the use of superfluid? I suppose.
Yes, I think so. And I think in terms of just the way in which you do things is in general in cryogenics, you know, high temperature superconductors were first discovered in the 80s. And it's taken a very long time. It's not surprising. It's a very complicated material. And it actually mirrors the amount of time it took to develop practical low-temperature superconductors after they were discovered in the early part of the 20th century. But now they're beginning to develop more and more of these devices, these conductors, and understanding how to use them so that we're seeing them in more and more applications. And I think that's something that will go on. And then you're sort of able to operate at kind of the 50 to 60 Kelvin level. And that really is sort of also the sweet spot for these small cryocoolers. So a combination of development of high temperature superconductors and small cryocoolers, again, I think is a longer term thing that'll happen and will reduce the sort of the need to operate at these temperatures.
I see. And I mean, I would have thought that the incredible efficiency and, you know, the fact that the substance doesn't form bubbles, that must be a huge advantage when you're trying to cool something. But is that offset by the extra expense of having to get another 2 Kelvin out of your cryogenic system?
Is that a huge expense? It is actually offset by that. And there's two things that happen. First of all, the first question I ask is, what temperature do I need to operate at? And for the magnets and the SRF cavities that we've talked about, it's true that the additional cost to cool things down a couple more degrees is well offset by the improved performance that you get. In the case of superconducting RF cavities, it's actually dependent on the frequency of the RF, it turns out. Because the material responds differently at different frequencies. So if it's a very low frequency system, sort of in the 80 megahertz range of RF and of RF frequency, it actually turns out that calculation doesn't hold. It's thermodynamically better to operate at, say, 4.5K, though you still now have the bubble problem. And that may also mean that you would operate at 2K anyway. But at higher frequencies, you know, 300 megahertz and higher, you definitely win by going down to 2 Kelvin. And so that plus the removal of bubbles really drives that as the right thing. I think that what one might see in the future is, and people are working on this, is the idea of cooling these cavities, not by immersing them in liquid helium, but by rather attaching them to a cryocooler. That has its own challenges. The cavities are susceptible to vibrations, and cryocoolers are mechanical devices. But there are people that are working on that. Mm. I also think the other place that we'll still see helium-2 being used in a lot of places for the next, I'm going to guess, 20 years or so. But I also think that the technological trends are going sort of more away from that, simply because there are other ways to achieve what you want to do.
Mm. And John, as I was reading your book, it dawned on me that there are several Nobel Prizes for physics that are, I suppose, made possible by the use of helium-2. Do you have a favorite out of those prizes?
Yes, I do, actually. Lee Osheroff and Richardson, won the Nobel Prize for discovering superfluidity in helium-3. This is the other isotope of helium. Mm. Now, helium-3 is not a boson, and so the mechanism by which it becomes a superfluid is not Bose-Einstein condensation. It's rather something much more similar to what you see in superconductors, where it's more of a Cooper pair kind of a thing. It only occurs at about below about 2.7 millikelvin. But what I like about their discovery was that they weren't really looking for this. They were looking for something else. They were doing fundamental measurements in helium, in the helium-3 isotope. And as a part of those measurements, they saw a phenomenon that they were able then to describe, that they were able then to describe as superfluidity and a superfluid phase in helium-3. And in fact, there are three superfluid phases in helium-3 because helium-3 is also has a magnetic moment. And so magnetism, putting a magnetic field on it, also affects the phases. So their discovery was really a case of serendipity, and I really like that. I like the fact that someone was looking for one thing, and in the process of looking for something, found something entirely different and interesting. And I think some of the most exciting scientific discoveries you get are those that occur in that manner, where it's not, I'm looking for X and I found X. It's, I'm looking for X and, oh, what is this over here? And in many cases, that's the far more interesting thing. So I think that's my favorite one.
And the two different types of, well, broadly different types of superfluid, the two different isotopes, are they both used in a dilution fridge, or is it does that not have anything to do with superfluid?
Well, yes. I mean, because of the temperature levels in a dilution fridge, typically there is a pot that operates at about 2 Kelvin, so that has superfluid helium in it. They don't really take advantages of the superfluidity of that at all. It's really just, but they do have the advantage that the liquid in that vessel at 2 Kelvin is isothermal because of the high heat transfer in the heat within helium-2. And they do have to worry about some design features to prevent, for instance, the helium from crawling up the wall of the container and into the pumping line and being lost. In the case of the helium-3 part of the dilution fridge, they don't operate. Well, they actually, that's not true. They might operate cold enough that some of that will become superfluid, but I don't think that has much of an effect on the design or the use of it.
And so at the moment, we associate superfluidity with helium. Is it possible that there are any other superfluids out there that we haven't seen? Possibly we haven't gone cold enough to see them?
You never want to say never in these sorts of questions. So I think it could be entirely possible. I think it's somewhat unlikely. You know, one of the features of helium is that it's the coldest liquid we have. So any other element becomes a solid long before it gets down to these temperatures. So it seems to me that it's probably unlikely, but I won't say no. I will say that there have been experiments using that have created other Bose-Einstein condensates using lasers and I think ruthenium gases. It's a different sort of it is truly a Bose-Einstein condensate, but it operates at a very cold nuclear or molecular temperature, I think. Mm. But it's not a bulk fluid at all.
Well, thanks, John. That was a fascinating conversation. And John's book is called Superfluid, How a Quantum Fluid Revolutionized Modern Science. And it's published by Springer. And you can read my review on the Physics World website. Just look for the headline, Superfluidity, the Mysterious Quantum Effect That Became a Backbone of Experimental Physics. Thanks for being on the podcast, John.
Thank you very much, Hamish. It was nice to be here.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to John Wisand for joining me today, and to our producer, Fred Isles. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Pfeiffer Vacuum. We'll be back again next week, but in the meantime, do check out the latest episode of the Physics World Stories podcast. Host Andrew Glester is in conversation with the composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg, whose The Moon's Symphony takes listeners on an epic journey through the science and stories of the moons of the solar system. The podcast includes music from the symphony, and you can find it on the Physics World website or at your favorite podcast provider. Just look for the headline, An Orchestral Trip Through the Moons of Our Solar System. Thanks again to Pfeiffer Vacuum for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Pfeiffer Vacuum provides all types of vacuum equipment, including hybrid and magnetically levitated turbopumps, leak detectors and analysis equipment, as well as vacuum chambers and systems. Besides, they offer products that have been specially developed for accelerator applications. You can explore all of its products at pfeiffer-vacuum.com.
Physics World.